reach the Outrider Podcast.
Hello and welcome to episode 17 of the Outrider Podcast. I am Jason Quinn Malott. I'm thinking I need to do a new intro. Anyway, today's episode is a very important one for me. I'm very excited about it. I had a great conversation with Laird Hunt, and I think you're going to have a good time with it. Laird is a fellow Naropa graduate, although he is was a few years before I was, and he's also quite a big deal, in case you didn't notice. He was a Penn Faulkner Award finalist for his last novel, Kind One. It also won an, what is it? It's the Ainsworth Wolf Book Award. So that's a huge deal. His new book is coming out in September. It's called Never Home, and that's going to come out from Hachette, which, in case you didn't know, is being bullied by Amazon at the moment. So let me take a brief detour and throw this out there. Go visit a local independent bookstore. You can go to indiebound.org and find the local independent bookstore in your area. If there's not one, there is one, I am sure, nearby. And they almost always will ship to you. And of course, the bigger the independent bookstore is, the more likely they are to offer free shipping the way Amazon does. So you can try Powell's or The Strand or something like that, which has online ordering functions. Of course, most local independents do that as well. I know Watermark Books here in my hometown of Wichita, Kansas, does ordering, but they do unfortunately charge shipping. So if you happen to live in town, just start going to a local independent. It's so much better. There's actually a person there you can talk to. You can talk about books. They bring writers in, like Laird Hunt, to talk to you and your bookish friends about their books and other books and whatever else happens to be going on in the literary thing. And, you know, that's just so much better than Amazon. Okay, yes, you will pay the full cover price. For shame. Why do you pay the full cover price at an independent bookstore? Because that bookseller needs a paycheck, and the lights need to be kept on, and events need to be scheduled and planned. So, you know, you should go out and support your local independent bookstore and quit buying things from Amazon. Oh, you can also get an e-reader, a Kobo e-reader, that works with EPUB format and is actually in partnership with the American Booksellers Association, so you can get a Kobo reader and buy ebooks from your local independent bookstore. It's just not that hard. Get out there, support the local flora and fauna of your book world, and you won't have any delays getting Laird Hunt's new book in September from Hachette, because you won't have to go through Amazon. So, done with the detour. Let's get back to it. I'm very, very excited about the conversation with Laird Hunt, about sharing that with you. It kind of went a little faster than I wanted it to. He had to get moving, so we didn't go for a full hour, and I feel like it kind of refocused my mind. So we didn't cover some things that I kind of wanted to. And of course, I did not. There was one part of the conversation where I talk about one of his earlier books. Oh, his earlier books. His first book was a collection of short stories called The Paris Stories. His first novel was The Impossibly, followed by Indiana, Indiana, which was then followed by The Exquisite, and then Ray of the Star. And I love all of his books. Indiana, Indiana was my go-to hand sell when I was a bookseller. I would pull that out if someone had ever expressed an interest in Michael Ondaatje or John Berger and was looking for something different, but sort of in that same vein, I would pull out Indiana, Indiana and put that in their hands. Right, so in the conversation that I had with Laird, there was a brief moment where I confessed that two of his novels, The Impossibly and The Exquisite, he was doing something in those that I couldn't quite get my brain wrapped around. And I really struggled with the book. And the thing that I didn't get a chance to tell him was that even though I was struggling with it and not able to quite wrap my brain around it in that I want to understand this way, I was enjoying myself. It was kind of like, you know, it's kind of like being high. I don't know what I'm doing or why I'm doing it, but I'm having a good time. And, you know, sometimes you have to come down. And it's time for me to go back and retry those two books because of something that he points out in the conversation. So that's going to be my project between now and September, is to go back and see if my brain is ready to understand what Laird was doing in those two books. And if you've read them and love them, I will be joining you there soon. But that's neither here nor there. I just wanted to kind of get that out there so that if Laird's listening, he knows that I did not dislike those books. I enjoyed them greatly. I just didn't get it at the time and gave up. Anyway, but I think you're going to like this conversation. We kind of, you know, go pretty quick, trying to fit it into a 45-minute stretch there. So maybe I'll try and have him back. So anyway, let's get to it. Quit my babbling and let's get to Laird Hunt.
Hello?
Laird Hunt.
Yes.
This is Jason Malott.
Hey, Jason.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. Yourself?
Oh, I'm doing all right. You know, I'm playing hooky from work, so uh-huh. That's always good. We'll try and get you out of here as quick as possible. You said you'd had to take off about 11:45?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay, no problem at all. Have you had a chance to... I don't know if you've had a chance to hear any of the other episodes before, but it's really kind of informal, conversational. I like the podcasters who inspired me to finally use my Mac this way. Don't do research, so I don't really either.
Okay. Sounds good.
What I always like to do, though, is start off with people's origin stories, because, you know, writers are actually closeted superheroes, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? So, originally, whereabouts are you from?
Well, my story is kind of, it's both simple and elaborate in curious ways, I suppose, at least curious to me. And I'll get to that, the curious part of it a little in just a second, but I was born in Singapore.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and then lived briefly in San Francisco, and then London, Netherlands. And then from the Netherlands went to Greenwich, Connecticut for a year and lived with my grandparents, and then back to London and then to a farm in Indiana. And here's where it gets a little curious, because I spent the next 5 years during the school year. So we're in junior high now, and I spent the next 5 years in Indiana living on this farm with my grandmother, family uh-huh. farm that she had inherited. And then I would spend summers in Hong Kong with my father.
Wow.
So I went from this rural farm existence to this very urban international city on the other side of the world. And what was odd about it, and I think played some part in getting me started on this idea of writing, was that when I was in Indiana, apart from my grandmother, no one, and maybe a couple of relatives, no one ever asked me what it had been like over in Hong Kong, or even acknowledged it in a way. So I would go back to school in the fall, and I wouldn't ever have a teacher say, tell us what you did this summer. I know you went somewhere unusual. That kind of just never happened. And then in Hong Kong, I was, apart from my family, I was never asked about Indiana. In fact, that was a great way to get someone to stop talking to me would be to bring up the fact that I spent my school year playing basketball and football and running track and field in rural Indiana. Their eyes would glaze over. Right. And so, yeah, so I had a kind of split existence, and that's I've sort of continued that with spending part of my time in quieter places and part of my
right.
time in big cities.
Oh, well, then I guess we're done. No. What did your parents do that you were a globetrotting before puberty?
Right. My father's a business guy, and he, at the age of 25, went to Singapore and was a branch manager for Bank of America. He has never lived in the States since. So he's been overseas since before I was born and has stayed there. And, he comes back, obviously, to visit, but his place of residence has been overseas since the 60s. And he seems to enjoy that, although he's starting to shift, and so he might, or it looks like he will be spending part of his time in Seattle, part of his time in Hong Kong.
Wow.
And the reason I went to the farm in Indiana is my parents split up, and it seemed best at that juncture for various reasons for me to go to this stable place. And it turned out to be pretty fantastic, although I resisted it at first. But it was just the right thing for me, and certainly in terms of my writing, it was great to have some sense of a place where I had some pretty deep roots.
Huh. What did your mother do?
My mother has done all kinds of things. She was the artistic one, the unusual seer, the one who was particularly interested in language, so there was that side of her. She was trained as an interior decorator, and so she was able to manifest some of that. But she taught, and then for many years now she's worked at Johns Hopkins, although she's getting ready to retire. But she lives in Baltimore, and my father lives still, as I say, in Hong Kong, and part of the time in Seattle. So they're on. It's a very long. I have to go in two different directions to take my kid to see the grandparents on my side. Anyway.
Oh, so that might be why your dad's moving to the States more, as grandchildren.
Well, I think that there's some truth to that, and it's certainly a lot easier to get Eva, my daughter, out there to Seattle to see him than to go to Hong Kong.
Wow. So I just absolutely fascinates me. Because it's been hard for me to get out of Kansas.
Uh-huh.
My parents just very kind of, nose to the grindstone type of thing. My dad was a parole officer, of all things.
Oh, wow.
And then except for the 5 years in Colorado, I've kind of been stuck in Kansas. That vortex that around Wichita that Ginsberg wrote about.
That's the one. That doesn't sound so awful. Wichita's pretty great.
There needs to be more of a literary community, but.
Oh, there's that. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Well, it's funny. Some people sink deeper. They have a hard time with that, and I'm in the latter category, even though I crave it and love having some access to it through Indiana.
Right. Yeah. I think maybe having the global experience, you can value the Indiana aspect of it more than I can, because I want desperately still at 42 to get out of here. To experience something other than red state America.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a serious drawback for sure.
So you went to high school in Indiana. Where did you end up going to college?
I think through a kind of inertia, I went to Indiana University. Part of the reason for that was I was being recruited to play football. I had a very serious knee injury in high school that made a lot of the recruiters scared a lot of the recruiters off, but Indiana still, had an offer if I could demonstrate that the knee was sound, etc. I didn't end up playing football for Indiana. I sort of got there and thought, no, that's it, I'm done with that, and pursued other things. But that was what took me to IU, and it was a great experience. But of course, I wedged in a year abroad, even during those 4 years, and went to France and started my lifelong love of things French and French literature, etc. at that time.
Now, did you start writing in high school or younger, or was it just something that you picked up when you gave up football that was kind of always latent and hanging around down there?
You know, I didn't really, I mean, I took some, in high school, I wrote a couple of satirical pieces, but I didn't mm-hmm. think of them in any kind of, that there would be something I was going to continue. And even in college, I never took a writing workshop. I was studying literature, especially right. French literature, and then also history. And I suppose it was towards my senior year, and maybe actually that year when I was studying abroad, that I started making a few stabs without much seriousness. But it wasn't until I graduated from college and went and taught English for a year in Japan, and it was during that year that I decided I was going to become a writer and started making my first real, serious, sustained attempts at doing things. Some of which were poems, and mm-hmm. that seemed pretty quickly, fortunately, that wasn't going to be the avenue I was going to pursue. I was more interested in narrative. So I started writing some stories and joined something called the Tokyo Writers Workshop, which was a monthly gathering of uh-huh. expats and Japanese
oh, wow.
Aspiring writers in downtown Tokyo. And it provided a little bit of a sense of community. We would do things together. And so that's really where I started writing. And they had a magazine attached, or one of the key people ran a magazine.
Right.
Published my first story was published in that magazine.
Oh, cool.
Which I don't
anybody...
have a copy of.
Oh, right. Yeah. Has anybody else besides you risen up out of that writer's group?
Well, that's interesting. You know, I don't know. The people that I kept in touch with sort of, they stopped writing. And then uh-huh. you know, others, I don't remember their names. It's quite possible. Oh, well, there was one guy I met, Ewan Calcoon, who had a brief, he came to Naropa briefly. And so that's how I kept in touch with him. And he was continuing to write, but I haven't seen him in 20 years or
right.
heard much about him. So I don't know if he kept at it either. He was also a musician.
Right, yeah. Yeah, there's always something kind of distracting.
Yes.
For everybody.
That's for sure.
Wow. Now, I've always found that interesting, just to, because I'm always curious about lineage, because we all get to, there's the people that we brush up against accidentally and through circumstance, and then there are the writers that we kind of choose to align ourselves with. And it's interesting how those sometimes, to me, how they cross and how they influence and things like that. Because I think that if you happen to get around the right people at the right time, it can keep you motivated and keep you focused on, you know, doing the work rather than getting distracted by, you know, music or business or
yes.
or something like that.
All and, the possibilities.
Right?
Yeah.
Because I've sort of kind of kept tabs on people that I did my undergraduate with at K-State, and I was there at the same time as the poet Ed Skoog, who just had his second uh-huh. collection published from Copper Canyon Press.
Fabulous.
So, you know, it's something I like to keep track of. I was just curious. How long was it between then, you know, Indiana, your year in Japan, and then when you ended up at Naropa?
Well, it was actually not very long. So when I was over in Japan and mm-hmm. I was Tokyo Writers Workshop and trying to figure out writing, I started applying to some MFA programs. And the only reason I knew about them, I hadn't heard about this when I was in college, but I picked up an issue of Writer's Digest magazine at Kino Kuniya,
right.
Bookstore in downtown Tokyo, and it had the one that listed all of the little capsule descriptions of MFA programs.
Uh-huh.
And so I sort of went through them, and I didn't know how to register what was supposed to be really good or not. So I just went by the little description from
right.
my initial inquiries, and so I applied from that great distance to Oregon because I liked the poet Garrett Hongo, who was teaching there.
Mm-hmm.
I had seen some of his work. I was woefully underread, but he was someone I'd read, and I appreciated what he did. And then I applied to the MA PhD program in Nebraska. And I think that was about it. And I was waitlisted at Oregon, and I was accepted into the Nebraska program based on what whatever my efforts right. were. And so when I got back from the States after that year, I had a little bit of money in my pocket, and I decided, you know, like a wise American, to sink some of it into a car. And I jumped in my car and went driving around with this idea that I would visit the various places I was interested
right.
in. And so I started with Nebraska, and it was really an underwhelming experience, let's say. I mean, part of it was when I was driving, driving through the cornfields, which felt just right. like Indiana to me. And so I knew I'd had that part of the experience. And then as soon as I got to campus, and this was in the summertime, but, you know, there, well, I don't know why I should say, but the first people I saw were a couple of hulking football players.
Right.
And that to me was another sort of like, oh, you know, that was the other life that
right.
And then I got up to the English department and had an appointment with the acting director. And he said to me, I love telling this, that, you know, he sort of knew who I was, or, you know, and understood that I was this, you know, admitted to the program, but he didn't have much interest. And mm-hmm. he said, talking about the funding, and I had not received the top funding from those places where they tier right. that. And he said, you know, and I'm sure I didn't say, well, you know, why didn't I get it? But he sort of volunteered that the people who had gotten the top funding had shown great mindedness in their applications.
What?
And then the implication being that I had not somehow demonstrated this great mindedness. But at any rate, it was a combination of things that led me to decide to, I think I asked for a deferral just to have a little time to think about it. And I went right. off on this drive around the country visiting MFA programs that I'd done more research and I'd heard more about them. I somehow at the end of this ended up in Boulder. But I shouldn't say somehow ended up. I was heading that way because my mm-hmm. sister was living in town. But I thought, why not go take a look at this place that was described in Writer's Digest as physics meets the Buddhist mind or something like that.
Right.
And I thought, okay, well, you know, it can't hurt. I'd been to these other places and not been very inspired, including my meeting at Memphis State with the director or the chair or someone who was clearing out his office with great energy and talking about what a shitty place it was. He had just been fired.
Wow.
And so I arrived at the rope, and it was the end of the summer writing program. But even in the midst of the chaos of people turning in final manuscripts, mm-hmm. time was made to chat with me and to offer yeah. things about themselves, about their own writing, and then to ask me about my writing, et cetera. And I was sort of hooked right away mm-hmm. by that personalized experience. And so I stayed and right. enrolled. And I think, you know, at that time, no one was turned away. All comers yeah. were taken. I didn't know that. It felt like a great achievement to be accepted. But it turned out to be pretty amazing. And then I promptly, after a semester, left and went back to Japan. I thought that I was clearly in the frame of mind that needed to constant refreshment or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like, okay, I had a semester, had a great experience with Bobby Louise Hawkins. I took a class with
right.
Tom Hollow that was terrific. And I thought maybe that was
yeah.
enough. And I left, but then I got drawn back. And so mm-hmm. it took me about 5 years, but I finally, when I was living in New York with Eleni, received my MFA in the mail. So it took a while.
Right.
I got it done.
Yeah. Oh. Naropa was the only place that I applied to, I think, mostly because it didn't require me to take the GRE.
Yeah, that's right.
And, you know, and I knew I was going to get in trouble because it was a private school and tuition would be higher and all
yeah.
that other stuff. But the chance to interact with that many writers in a given year, I mean, between the regular semester and then the summer writing program, that was impossible to pass up.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I look around at other MFA programs at their visiting writer thing and go, that's paltry. You know, one writer a semester outside of your faculty? What's that about?
Yeah.
You know, and I always feel like such a name dropper when I tell people about Naropa, because I can go like, oh, yeah, I met Lawrence Ferlinghetti and Bob Creeley and, you know, just knock
exactly.
down the line.
Yeah.
And it's like, I got to, you know, hear what they had to say. I, you know, I'm 2 degrees of separation away from, you know, some of my idols. That's my new literary game. I've taken 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon and I've turned it into 6 degrees of Ezra Pound.
That's, you can get pretty close with with the Naropa faculty for sure. Yeah. Oh yeah. No, you're absolutely right. It was an amazing place to be, and then, you know, on top of the, what was really a pretty intimate focused experience during the year, that summer writing program was, I was Creeley's assistant. I had breakfast with him. Mm-hmm. He was in his pancakes. I mean, we ate pancakes and he was in his pajamas, but I like the idea of him wearing pancakes better. Or, you know, that's where we became friends with Michael Ondaatje, and we were friends with him. And, I, you know, hung out with Allen Ginsberg.
That's what I've been wanting to ask you about. I mean, you were there when he was still alive. What was he like as in person?
Well, he was a remarkably serious teacher, and I wasn't quite prepared for that. He was not into kidding around or joking around or any kind of lackadaisical experience when he talked.
Right.
I attended a Blake seminar one summer that he held at his apartment with, I guess there were 10 or 12 of us who would go to his apartment, and we really had a pretty amazing experience in terms of the seriousness with which he approached it, and the intelligence of the things that he had to say. The intelligence was a given, but it doesn't always translate to the teaching experience. And so that for me, it was kind of a revelation. And then of course he would do his more public lectures, and they would always
be
quite something. And then, you know, he was very amicable, friendly, and, you know, I remember one time at a party we talked for 45 minutes, and he really just wanted to hear about what I was up to. And it wasn't that he wouldn't answer questions and that sort of thing, but he just kept asking me questions. And you
can imagine
for a 20-something aspiring writer, it was a pretty flattering experience. And it wasn't because, you know, and I wasn't under the illusion that it was because he sensed some great brilliance or something in me.
Right.
And he just was, he would do this with, you know, with all of us. He just really had this deep hunger for hearing about the people that surrounded him, the people in the world.
Well, that's a human compassion, curiosity, concern thing. That's I guess what I would worry about writers that didn't have that capacity.
Yeah. Well, I think many writers have that, but then they have a counter, which is a crippling shyness or an inwardness or something that keeps them from being able to act on their desire to know more about the world. And I suppose there are some misanthropes out there too. different types of writers.
Yeah, that shyness was a problem of mine when I was younger, and then, you know, came back to Wichita after grad school, and realized that I'd kind of talked to every writer in town that interested me. You know, and that I wasn't going to be getting out of here anytime soon. So I figured I'd better just, you know, start making some phone calls.
What are you doing with Wichita? You said you're playing hooky from work.
Right. Well, okay. The first rule of Jason's day job is you don't talk about Jason's day job. I do technical, I edit business and technical documents for a rather large corporation that shall remain nameless.
And so that keeps you, so that obliges you to be in Wichita.
Yeah. It's the first job since graduate school that paid me enough to be able to live on my own and pay my student loans.
Very nice. Essential.
Right?
Yeah. But for me, it took going to work at the United Nations to finally be able to pay off my Naropa experience.
Right.
And fix my teeth.
Now, I want to say you were a translator at the UN, right? Or were you
No, I wasn't. I was I worked in the press service. I was a press officer.
Okay.
And what that meant in that context was providing meetings coverage service for the General Assembly and mm-hmm. Security Council. So our office.
Wow.
Largely former journalists. I was a little bit of an exception. From mm-hmm. on the one half of this very large office, it was English-speaking press officers. On the other, it was the French-speaking press officers. So people came from all over the world. A lot of in the English core, lots of East Africans, for example.
Right.
And on the French side, West Africans, North Africans,
wow.
as well as French and French Canadians. It was a great place for me to be because I had French and. Mm-hmm. I had the international experience, and our office was right outside the entrance to the Security Council. So you never knew who you were going to see when you were coming up the escalator to work.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, the escalator took you right past Picasso's Guernica tapestry. He oversaw the construction of a tapestry
oh, wow.
version of Guernica, and the same size. It's very large and extraordinary. And then you might come up to the top of the escalator, which is right where the dignitaries and ambassadors address mm-hmm. the press. And one time I came out and Nelson Mandela was there, for example.
Oh, wow.
You know, or Yasser Arafat was going by in the hallway surrounded by his entourage, that kind
oh,
of thing.
Wow.
One of the most, and you know, it wasn't just people, giants
right.
in the international political world. One time I was editing some terribly turgid copy at my desk, and we heard this crazy sound outside that seemed to go rocketing up the side of the Secretariat building.
Uh-huh.
And without even looking up, one of my colleagues said, oh yeah, Aretha's here today. She's dedicating some monument. So it was Aretha Franklin who'd led
oh, wow.
with this amazing volley of sound. But that was the kind of thing, you know, Pavarotti would come by.
Right.
I found myself absurdly shaking oh. hands one day with Danny Glover, and it was, and he had tears in his eyes, and he was thanking me so much for coming, and it was absurd because, not because of his emotions, but because I was coming in to cover the next press conference, which was going to be about some peacekeeping situation.
Mm-hmm.
And
amazing.
So I was just coming in to set up, but he was thanking everyone. And so this he's a very tall guy, and he reached over someone else's shoulder to shake my hand. And,
oh, wow.
And so I sort of said, I'm such a pleasure, you know, the way you mumble these things.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, those kinds of encounters happened
right.
with great regularity.
What years were you there at the UN?
I was there, let's see, I guess I was there from 97 to 2002.
Okay.
So 5 years.
Okay. So you got there after the end of the Bosnian War.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
That's right.
I was just curious.
Yeah, yeah. So I was, I mean, there were lots of residuals that one had to cover about mm-hmm. that situation, but things, the central conflicts were elsewhere. And so,
right.
curiously enough, I was not there. I had taken a break in service in the fall of 2001 with the idea that I needed to full-time promote my first novel. It was a very odd idea. But I was sort of already starting to think, because the work was draining, exhausting, and maybe I could find something else to do. And so I took an experimental time off just as September 11th happened. So even though I was in Manhattan, lower Manhattan, when it uh-huh. on that morning, I was not working at the.
Oh, wow.
But it was very odd not to be in touch with all of the people there, and also to be going to Security Council to, you know, help with the mm-hmm. coverage and that sort of thing. And then I went back to work in the early part of the next year for the
amazing.
Final.
You were in lower Manhattan on the day.
I was, yeah. And I, you know, I don't want to do that exaggeration thing and make it sound closer than I was. I was on the Lower mm-hmm. East Side,
right.
Houston and Delancey. So I was, mm-hmm. I was not, you know, I was certainly wasn't
kind of on the other side of the island from.
But, you know, it was certainly close. I mean, it was one of those crazy things. I was actually sleeping when the first I was sleeping in. I wasn't working.
Right.
And when the first plane hit, and it wasn't until the phone started ringing and turned on the TV and saw what was going on and went upstairs to the top of our building just after the second plane had hit. So I saw the enormous plume of smoke, et cetera. And then started to see people, because people were streaming up from downtown. And a very vivid memory of a businessman completely covered in ash with an ash-covered briefcase just walking down the street. And people streaming over the bridge. We lived right near the Manhattan Bridge, streaming over that sort of chaos. But I wasn't, I certainly breathed for the next 6 days that horrifying air.
Wow.
But I'd never put on a gas mask, as some people did. Maybe I should. It'll come back to haunt me.
That's astounding. That's astounding. Yeah, you know, there was a friend of mine who now was in graduate school in New York, I think at a film school at New York on 9/11. And I think part of his route to school or whatever took him through the train station under the World Trade Center.
Yeah.
And I don't know, either he didn't have class that day or was doing something, but he wasn't in that area, and it kind of freaked him out. And he came back to Wichita after that. It's been a number of years here, you know, kind of gave up on the film school thing and everything after that. And then got married, and his wife decided that she wanted to go and get a master's degree in, I think, journalism or communications or something like that. She was working for the TV stations here. So they went back to New York. I think he finally had got the nerve for it.
Yeah.
And now he writes for, he went, and then after his wife finished graduate school, he did a cultural studies or cultural criticism graduate degree. Now he works for Flavor Wire, and she's a producer for the Chris Hayes Show.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, it's weird how stuff happens, but
yeah, I think a lot of people needed to get away. And you know, it's probably true that that was part of our move to go and take when we were invited to come out and teach, to share a position in Europa. That was certainly it was weighing on our mind. I mean, the city.
Right.
It seemed a less exciting place, let's put it that way. For us, there was a kind of sense of huge unshadowed hope about living in New York as young writers,
right,
etc. But, you know, on the one hand, Eleni was teaching poetry in the schools and getting worn out, traipsing around the five boroughs to sometimes very tough situations, with heartbreaking situations with kids in bad straits. And then I was working at the UN and sometimes spending the night on the office floor waiting for the Security Council to meet being on call over the weekends and that kind of thing. And it was very exciting, but it was also, you know, it was just that plus then September 11th happens, and there's all kinds of things start to come into your considerations. And so when there was this chance, we initially thought, oh, we'll go out for a brief stint and then come back to New York. But it's going back to New York, I think a lot of people have experienced that, so maybe your friends were sort of the exception, but the breadcrumbs have all been eaten. You can't see the trail back to the city, and it comes to seem very far away. But you know, we scratch the itch. We visit a lot. I'm going there. This time next week, I'll be in New York
For BEA.
For BEA, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, you're going to be on that panel with my friend Emily.
Oh wait, which friend? Emily.
Emily St. John Mandel.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. She's terrific.
Yeah. Have you met her before?
I met her briefly at AWP. I'm not even sure she would remember that, but she was, I think she had just arrived, and I was introduced by a coffee house person to her.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so jealous, because you guys are having all the fun.
Well, it'll be one of those interesting kinds of fun, I think. I am really looking forward to it, but it's also a little daunting, a little intimidating.
Ah, you'll do fine.
Yeah.
So you were in New York when The Impossibly came out, and you were working on promoting that, which was...
That's right. Uh-huh.
Okay.
I had the book tour from hell, September 11th season. it wasn't just September 11th season to go out on the road with a debut novel. It was also the season of The Corrections by Jonathan Franzen.
Right.
So I had quite a convergence of bad situations, like a perfect storm, to create almost total anonymity for the young writer who had quit his job to promote his novel. it was pretty pretty eye opening. Let's just say.
Now, had you started, or were you already finished with Indiana, Indiana by that point?
You know, Indiana, Indiana was drafted, the bulk of the book was drafted before The Impossibly.
So wow!
It was really my first novel, but not first finished. And I wrote that and wrote it into a sort of acceptable, to myself anyway, state. And I did try it with a few publishers to see if I could, you know, if anyone would take it. But there weren't any, you know, it was short. It was just didn't seem finished to them. And I think they were quite right. And so I started The Impossibly and wrote that. And then before I had finished The Impossibly, I started The Exquisite.
Okay.
And
now this makes some sense to me.
Okay.
Because I have all of your books so far, except for the Paris stories.
Okay.
And I tell you the truth, I struggled a bit with The Impossibly and The Exquisite. There, I think there's something you're doing there that hasn't yet quite clicked in my brain.
Uh-huh.
I think Bobby used to talk about this, is that, you know, sometimes you'll get into a story and it's not clicking because your brain hasn't quite caught up to what the author's doing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you put it down and set it aside and come back to it, you'll be suddenly like, oh.
Right.
And I had that experience with Salman Rushdie's The Satanic Verses.
Oh, uh-huh.
Of course, I was tried to read it first when I was 16, so
there you
that might have been part of it.
Yep.
And
you were a much more advanced 16-year-old than I was, even just trying.
Well, I think the reason I bought it and picked it up was because I went to what was then considered the hillbilly redneck high school in one of the suburbs of Wichita.
All right.
And I was a very rebellious high school student.
Uh-huh.
I wrote a column for the school newspaper. I joined the girls' volleyball team. And
outstanding.
And so when all that uproar about the Satanic Verses was going on, I got it and was carrying it around school to read it just for the shock value. And,
great.
You know, when it finally clicked, I fell in love with it. And the same thing happened to me with Lawrence Durrell's The Alexandria Quartet.
Oh, uh-huh.
I sat down to read Justine first, and it didn't quite click. It didn't go down very well. And I put it aside, and when I finally went back to it, I blew through all four books in about a month.
Wow.
Loved it. It's now on my shelf. But Indiana, Indiana, Ray of the Star, and Kind One, I adore those books. I want you to know that. I have my little pantheon of writers, you know, Michael Ondaatje, John Berger, Lawrence Durrell, your books.
Good company.
Just because of the attention to language and the images and the detail. I love it. So I'm going to go back and check out The Impossibly and The Exquisite again, see if my brain's caught up with you.
Well, who knows? Who knows, right? I mean, that may not be it at all. It's a very generous way to put it. But I mean, I think that's we all have that, right? There are indeed those books that we never quite find our way into. The entrances just aren't ones that we can fit through. And
right.
It does, you know, I don't think it lessens the love we have for other books. I mean, there are some writers who love everything they've written, but you know, some writers we love some of what. I like to think we're ahead of the game when we find a kinship with even just part of the output. And you know, my books have deliberately all been different. It's been very important to me to pursue different strategies with each books, and so that's made it I think challenging. That I have, you know, I have. You're a little bit unusual because you include Ray of the Star in the books that are, you know, have worked for you, because a lot of times people like the the city books, let's say, and they like the country books, so Indiana, kind one. And it's not always the case that people like certain of both of those, so that's very interesting to me.
Maybe that means I'm ready for the impossibly and the exquisite, because it clicked right away. And it could be partly with what I'm trying to work on right now. I mean, I'm trying to do what, you know, the writers that I admire do, which is do something different, challenge yourself every time you go out there. Don't fall into a pattern or a habit or something that could be taken as a formula. I think that's dangerous. You know, so the novel that I'm trying to sell right now is a straightforward, linear narrative. It's not broken up or disjointed the way Evolution of Shadows was. And then I'm working on another one now that's, I'm trying to incorporate a kind of a ghost story into it and things like that, and doing some stuff, which actually might have been why Ray of the Star kind of clicked with me.
Maybe so. Because
that's something that I'm kind of trying to do with this one. So.
Fascinating. So you are doing different kinds of things.
Yeah, I'm hoping I'm doing different things.
So where are you with what you've got one that's out now, you say?
Came out in 2009.
I've read that. I mean, the one that you're looking to. I like that book quite a bit. You're the one that you're looking to sell. So you've got that sort of with it, with editors, or you're strategizing on who to send to, kind of thing. How's that work?
I've got it out to a couple of agents and to a couple of small presses. Zank Books and $2 Radio are looking at it.
Oh, they're great. Both of those.
Excellent. And I'm kind of really got my fingers crossed for Zank Books because my editor for the first book is on the advisory board.
Oh, fantastic.
So, you know, who knows?
That is a good connection. We just had a student in the PhD program at DU who had her manuscript accepted by Zank, so she's over the moon.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. I'm very pleased to see that there are some more and more Naropa graduates out there getting books published.
Yeah.
Rachel Weaver did her MFA at Naropa and's got a book coming out. It's out now.
That's right. I blurbed that book, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. So I'm like excited for that one. She's going to be in Wichita. I'm going to see if I can twist her arm and get her on the show here.
Fantastic. She's great. I had her in a couple of summer writing program workshops.
Nice.
I was teaching. We've
got a few. We've got a few minutes left here before I let you go.
All right.
And there's always kind of one general question that I do like to ask everybody. You know, there's some people will notice that, you know, every year there's that those studies and reports that show that literary reading is declining, and people aren't interested in reading, and bookstores are struggling, and Amazon's taking over the universe, and publishers are struggling. And it seems to me that we as writers, we kind of have a vested interest in maintaining an audience, not just for our own books, but for books in general.
Yeah.
And I'm always curious, what is it that you think that we as writers can do outside of just writing our books? What can we do to kind of encourage people to read, to pick up a book when there's so much other distractions out there and an education system that kind of crushes people's native intelligence and curiosity when it comes to reading?
I think that you're absolutely right that it's essential to be thinking about this and doing what we can, and maybe even a little bit more than we can. And you know, I think about the model of what Lenny has continued to do. I mean, we both teach at the university and graduate level, which is great. And I think that is important. The work of the imagination is terribly important. However you can do it, whether it's through your own writing, whether you're reviewing, whether you're writing articles, etc. But you know what she continues to do after those years in New York is she founded a Writers in the Schools program for the Front Range area that's now operating in Denver, from Boulder, meaning she has writers, young fiction writers, and poets teaching kids, and not just kids who have the advantages. Kids in the public school system are getting access to poetry and the idea that wild mind is something
right.
to continue to cultivate. And so I think that working with kids and encouraging them, and you know, in my case, I had an extraordinary experience a couple of years ago getting to go to Africa and work with writers of all ages in Kinshasa and Brazzaville in the two Congos, and so getting a chance to work with writers who have not had access to this idea that the work of the imagination through writing is interesting, nourishing, or even possible for that matter in some cases. And so you know, we've also been involved in founding a school that operates part of the time in Morocco. And so working with kids, young adults, and writers of different ages, but giving them, you know, it's sort of learning from them as we give them access to something like the workshop model, where they can be in conversation with their peers to produce things. And even if it doesn't lead to much more than that, what they've had is an extraordinary, enriching experience that illuminates life in different ways. And so a combination of things on the home front, and then also in the far-flung parts of the world, to be how I've been thinking about it.
Awesome. I'm trying to get a literary festival started in Wichita. Trying to get the various faction groups that don't talk to each other because they're all very cliquish and about protecting their own, you know.
Oh yeah, that's alive and well in many parts of the world.
So I'm hoping to try and, you know, get them to actually talk to each other and show that. Because Watermark Books here in Wichita does a bang-up, you know, unacknowledged sometimes job of keeping the literary light scene going here in Wichita. They bring in writers all the time.
Fantastic.
And I hope they're working with your publisher to bring you here. That would be cool.
That would be really cool.
When does Never Home come out?
September 9th is the pub date.
Okay, cool. Got that on my list.
All right.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with me. I really appreciate it. It's fun.
Really great for me as well, Jason. And let's stay in touch.
Absolutely. All right. And there you have it. My conversation with Laird Hunt. I hope you enjoyed it. I had a good time with it. Don't forget his new book, Never Home, will be out in September on the 9th. And you should pick that up at your favorite local independent bookstore. Be back in 2 weeks, where I will have the poet Shaindell Beers. I hope I pronounced her first name right. That'll be the first question I ask her. See you in 2 weeks.